This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Northwest Indiana political activist Ruth Needleman is usually a very busy person. But, of course, not only the pandemic, but the winter weather seems to have a big impact on what we all get to do these days. And I understand, Ruth, that you have been pretty much sequestered at home, at least for the time being. And hope you're doing
for a year or so.
And hope you're doing okay. And I hope you get a chance to get out and do something here. But let us know what you have been doing and some of the things you've been witnessing recently.
Okay, I've got a few things. The first is this incredible vote by the General Assembly in Indianapolis to override a veto from the governor. It's Bill SEA 148 that basically tells the rest of the state that you can pass no legislation to protect renters from gouging or from being evicted during this pandemic. And the legislature, which usually doesn't vote so progressively, actually they passed it, but the governor vetoed it, and then they overrode the veto.
Mm-hmm.
And this is pretty atrocious in the midst of the pandemic, when people who rent tend to be the people who've lost their jobs, people who have low income to begin with, and now they will have zero protection from eviction. Similarly, in the city of Gary, residents are being faced with a 73% increase in the cost of trash collection. Another unbelievable thing at a time when people's income has been squeezed almost dry. The sanitary district is gouging the public to make up for a few years of mismanagement in the past. Now, the city council and the mayor were going to do something about it. I'm still waiting because I can't believe that we would have to pay double what we now pay. Then there was a campaign going on, which was led by Black Lives Matter. More than a year ago, an 82-year-old senior citizen, Melvin Bowler, was sitting in his car near his house when police fired 9 bullets through his windshield and killed him.
Mm-hmm.
People have been waiting for over a year for any word from the prosecutor's office. And so the first week in February into the second week, we made dozens of phone calls demanding that the prosecutor release information on what's going on. However, we have not heard a word. This happened with Rashad Cunningham, who was also killed in front of his house inside his own car. And in this case, like in many others, the prosecutor said that it was justified. A small note on COVID. Mm-hmm. This is a call out to everybody. I've had my 2 shots. Please schedule your appointment, get your shots. The only way we will be able to restore any kind of semblance of normalcy is if everybody gets their shots. Now, I want to announce 2 upcoming Zoom meetings for people.
Okay.
Because 2 of our city council people in Gary have invited state legislators to a Zoom meeting. The first will be this Wednesday, the 25th at 6:30. Oh, wait. This Wednesday at 5:30, Linda Barnes Caldwell, city council representative, has invited Eddie Melton, Reagan Hatcher, Vernon Smith, and Earl Harris. The flyers for the event are up on their Facebook page, and there you can find the Zoom link. The other one will be held on Thursday at 6:30 with William Godwin, and he will be having Reagan Hatcher and Eddie Melton. There's quite a lot going on downstate in the legislature, not just preventing any kind of protection for renters, but there's also upcoming bills that seek to block any police reform. This is a good time to go to those 2 meetings, find out what's happening, and express your opinion. So, on a totally different note, because it's Black History Month, and not only do I read incessantly, but with COVID, I now watch incessantly, I wanted to do a little piece on what's happening in film. because there have been an incredible release of new films on Black history with a really disturbing common thread, which is that whenever a voice comes out strongly in support of Black people, the FBI kills them. Now, you might say, Ruth, she's out of her mind. What does she know? But I'll start with one of the older ones, which is Who Murdered Malcolm X? This is an extraordinary six-part documentary, and you find out towards the end, I don't want to ruin it, but it was not the Nation of Islam that killed Malcolm X. It was the New York police and the FBI, and his security guard, the person who stood next to him, was an FBI agent. That's really worth watching. Mm-hmm. Then there's one that's just coming out called Martin Luther King or MLK FBI. Now, I didn't love this movie, but it does show the unbelievable degree that J. Edgar Hoover persecuted Martin Luther King and followed him everywhere, tapped his phone. Now, one of the things he was trying to do was obviously discredit Martin Luther King by taping private personal interactions with women or other people. Now, tell you the truth, I don't care what Martin Luther King did in his own time. And I think the more dastardly thing was probably J. Edgar's involvement in the assassination of Martin Luther King. Because exposing someone's private life does not necessarily discredit, as unfortunately J. Edgar Hoover found out. And similar to that, another long-term campaign is going to be portrayed in something coming out this week or next. It's called The United States versus Billie Holiday. Now, when I think of Billie Holiday, besides unbelievable voice, I don't think about political protest. But in fact, the FBI dogged her every day of her life, trying to bring her up on charges of drug use. But behind that, and that's what this new documentary will show, the FBI tried to get her to stop singing Strange Fruit.
Oh.
It was considered to be such a dangerous song about lynching that they did an all-out campaign. Now, the older documentary, which is also interesting, is called Billy. And that shows that the FBI was involved in a lot of surveillance, but it mainly focuses on their jailing of Billie Holiday for drug use, when, in fact, what was behind the setup for drugs was actually the song Strange Fruit. Another person who used their voice to entertain America, Sam Cooke, who I adored, I never understood his death. It made no sense to me. And there's a new documentary called The Two Killings of Sam Cooke. And it shows that he became a target of the FBI when he developed a close friendship with Malcolm X, Jim Brown, and Muhammad Ali, which is depicted in One Night in Miami, another interesting film. When he wrote the song Change Gonna Come. And that made him, because he was a crossover artist, kind of like Billie Holiday, that made them too dangerous because too many people listened to them. Now, the last one I'll mention came out a week ago or 2 weeks ago called Judas and the Black Messiah, which is about the Black Panthers and Fred Hampton in Chicago. And just like the case of Malcolm X, it turns out that his closest security man was an FBI agent. What this film does is it shows how the FBI recruited him and got him to basically be as close to Fred Hampton as he could. This man not only drew a map of Fred Hampton's apartment, but fed him a powerful sleeping drug so that he would not wake up when they entered his apartment. and murdered him violently as he slept in bed with his wife. Excuse me.
Yeah. Well, I understand that particular film got a good recommendation as recently as last week from Kristen Dreyer Kramer, who does a real discovery here on Lakeshore Public Radio. She spoke very highly of the film. Judas and the Black Messiah.
I thought the film was excellent. I had one problem with it. I don't want to get into my little petty questions, but I worked with the Black Panthers out in California in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about the Panthers is that they promoted self-defense, but they were peaceful. They did free breakfast programs. They set up free child care. They did education in the community. This film is a little bit too gun-happy because really, I mean, when you see, which is great in the film, Fred Hampton meeting with the young lords and the white patriots in Chicago, building a coalition among oppressed groups. I mean, he was brilliant. He was what, 21 or 22 when they murdered him? And I think what these films together really show is that we can't believe the FBI on many fronts. So the FBI has also labeled Black Lives Matter as a great threat to our country's security.
Mm-hmm.
Just like they labeled Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Fred Hampton. And it seems that the greatest threat to our democracy has repeatedly come from agents inside our own government. And that's a very frightening realization. And I think it's very important currently to watch these films and to get a sense of it, because right now, when white supremacists basically organized a coup against our government, a lot of people still want to blame Black Lives Matter for violence. It's ridiculous.
Well,
that's my report.
Well, it sounds like a lot of opportunities to do a lot of binge watching coming up here if you haven't done so already. And Ruth, we'll let you take a drink of water, and we thank you for spending so much time talking about these topics and little reviews on these films that are coming out, and we'll watch for them as well too. Thank you for being with us today.
Sure thing. I'll be back.
And that's Northwest that's Northwest Indiana political activist Ruth Needleman here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Indiana Humanities recently awarded fellowships to four research projects examining some pivotal points in Indiana history to better understand and pursue racial justice. One of those projects is on a key event in Northwest Indiana history about the 1972 National Black Political Convention held in Gary. Independent scholar Nicole Poletica wants to find out if the famous conference had made an impact on local political views and action. And we spoke with Nicole the other day, and here's the conversation. Tell us more about the fellowships that the Indiana Humanities has set up to research more into some pivotal moments in Indiana's past. Tell us about the project, about the fellowships first.
I believe they were in response to the murder of George Floyd and then the protests about that, and I think it kind of got them thinking about maybe similar incidents in Indiana in its history, and so they created this fellowship under the name of Wilma Gibbs Moore, who was, I would say, like the Black archivist in Indiana, and she worked at the Indiana Historical Society, and I actually got to work under her, which was really enlightening. And she was just a wonderful lady. And she actually died shortly after retirement. And so I think they thought, what better way to honor her legacy and all the work that she did for Indiana Black history, collecting it and preserving it, than to name the fellowship for her.
Your research project has a very long name, which is which is called Tired of Going to Funerals, Transforming Protest into Policy at the 1972 National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana. What interested you in particular about this big event, very important event in Indiana and actually national history?
I don't think many people have even heard of it. And in my opinion, it should be kind of like a household name, like the Selma protest. I was actually doing research for a separate project. I was in my little digital newspaper database, and as always happens when you're researching something, you kind of get sidetracked by, you know, other pieces that were published. And so I saw a headline about a national black political agenda. And, you know, you hear the words like black agenda or gay agenda thrown around. And I was like, huh, what is this? And that just sent me down the rabbit hole for the next few days. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea that Gary was the site of this convention that historians describe as like a landmark and unprecedented, and it actually kind of made Jesse Jackson what he was. And so I feel like there's just so many layers to it, and I like could not get enough of researching about it, especially because I think it is so relevant now, where you know, you have the collective outrage about how Black Americans are being treated, and especially at the hands of police officers. And so we're kind of at the point where we're trying to figure out how to channel that outrage into structural reform. And that's kind of what they were doing in 1972, where, you know, the Black leaders had been assassinated. And while the protests and the sit-ins and the marches drew attention to the plight of Black Americans, there had yet to be really structural change. So I think at the end of the late 60s, early 70s, Black leaders were kind of trying to think about how to come up with like a new strategy for this kind of change. And to me, it seems like with BLM, you know, Black Lives Matter, they're at a similar point where they're kind of trying to figure out how to leverage that into lasting change. And I think that the convention, both of its successes and failures, can be informative for that movement.
Now, obviously, that National Black Political Convention that happened in Gary also was put together by a man who became, I guess, a bit more famous as well. And we were referring to the late Mayor Gordon Hatcher, who was one of the nation's actually first black mayors of a city. And I know that he worked very, very hard behind the scenes, mostly in getting this convention set up. If you've learned about that, did you find that surprising? Or was that something that you learned and you've been able to put together, and then in turn you can put together for the rest of the research project?
It's interesting. I think a lot of cities were hesitant to invite so many African Americans to their city. And of course, that was driven by discriminatory attitudes. But with Hatcher's election, I think that city kind of became known as a site of black political empowerment. And so I think they figured, you know, they have a friendly black police force, and Mayor Hatcher was known for being able to work with people of all ideologies, from black nationalists to congressional black caucus leaders. And so he was good at having those conversations and mediating between them. So I think ultimately that's why Gary was chosen to host the convention.
Now, once you get your research work done, it's being supported in this case through the Indiana Humanities Wilma Gibbs Moore Fellowship. What do you hope to do with it?
That is a great question. I think there really hasn't been a lot of attention paid to the convention in general. Most of it has been looked at, you know, on the national impact, but not a lot about how the convention influenced Gary residents and elected officials. And so I hope that I can kind of get the word out and identify people in the area that either helped plan the convention or attended it, and kind of learn about their experiences, and if that planted, you know, seeds of activism and kind of shaped what was important in their lives.
Now, do you have a timeline that you have to follow to have the project done so you can move it on forward into either creating more scholarly works or the podcast or anything else?
Yeah, we have a goal to finish it up by the end of the year. So right now we are actually working on a podcast for Talking Hoosier History about the convention. In the next few months, I hope to visit the Calumet Archives, the Gary Public Library, and maybe identify some people to speak with, kind of collect my research, and then analyze it a bit, and then work on writing a paper for it and maybe putting together some kind of public programming.
Well, Nicole, thank you very much for telling us about not only the fellowship that you've been able to receive to do the work that you're planning to do in the weeks and months ahead, and the best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Support for Nicole Politica's research into the National Black Political Convention is coming from a Wilma Gibbs Moore Fellowship from Indiana Humanities. Moore was a former Indiana Historical Society archivist and a librarian who had served as one of the state's preeminent scholars on black history. The city agency that helps more people of color and women become entrepreneurs in Indianapolis has more than doubled its consultations during the pandemic. And that's significant for a state that lags in its share of ventures led by people of color. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Priya Mahadevan reports today for us on some groups that are helping those entrepreneurs right now.
Lakaya Muhammad recently pivoted her professional attention to her personal hustle, natural cleaning products. She says the idea for her business came to her 5 years ago when she was unhappy with her job at a daycare.
And I happened to be in conversation with one of my sister friends, and we got to talking about a hack that she liked to clean out her tub. I'm like, oh my goodness, like, I can try this. I've been a little scientist since I was a child, always concocting something.
She started out with a multi-purpose cleaner.
It's plant-based, made with ingredients from the earth and essential oils.
Then a baby oil.
It also cures cradle cap.
And finally, an antiviral spray, right on time for the pandemic.
And you can spray it on surfaces to help sanitize, or you can spray it on your hands.
Muhammad's business went well enough that she could quit daycare and focus on it full time. And now she says the pandemic is her moment.
Everyone is becoming more conscious of health, so I've actually, my customer base has grown.
And she's one of many entrepreneurs of color leaning into their business this year.
People are home more. People are, you know, able to focus more and turn inward and think about what do they really want out of life.
That's Camille Blunt.
And I am the director of the Office of Minority and Women Business Development.
People from historically marginalized groups, including race, gender, disability, and veteran status, can apply for certification through that public agency. And once certified, they're able to compete for city contracts, and the agency promotes their businesses statewide. 2 years ago, 176 people approached the office for a business consultation. During the pandemic, that number more than doubled. And Blunt and others point out that's a trend we hope will continue.
Many white families have generational wealth, and it has been challenging for minorities to reach that level of wealth and that level of success. You know, encouraging entrepreneurship in diverse communities is really a way of helping our community be stronger and helping individuals really just leave a legacy for their families.
And because of those systemic inequities, many people struggle to even get to the point of certification. That's where people like Zakiya Walker come in.
They just need a little bit of access to capital where we then encourage them, we empower them to help that business.
Walker works for an initiative with the Indy Chamber that provides lending to low-wealth communities, including and especially to entrepreneurs of color. It's one of many community development financial institutions across the country, also known as CDFIs. They're especially useful to entrepreneurs who've been denied loans from traditional banks.
At the CDFI, we have a way of saying, well, how can we combat that denial?
That includes extra programs and coaching to help entrepreneurs get those loans. And just like the Office of Minority and Women Business Development, the Indy Chamber CDFI has also seen a jump in the number of people of color seeking support for business ventures. So thanks in part to federal pandemic assistance funds, it rapidly scaled up the loans it's offering from a typical 12 a year to 1,800 since March. More than half of those loans went to minority and women-owned businesses. And one of them was 28 Boutique, a women's clothing store owned by Angel Hicks.
I specialize in making women look good.
Especially in dresses.
It's nothing better than putting a dress on.
She's had her fair share of hurdles in getting the loan she needed to grow. But this year, she went to the Indy Chamber CDFI.
And when I went in there, it was this ray of sunshine.
She's talking about Zakiya Walker.
And we connected immediately because she had this really cute jacket. When I saw her jacket, I was like, oh, yeah, she is my customer. This lady gonna like me. And she's going to like me because I cater to the people that look like her.
Walker ended up helping Hicks secure a loan in 2020. She says it helped her stay afloat.
I was like skating by. The only thing I knew what to do. was to just go to work and just, you know, even if it was a couple hundred dollars every week, just throw it into the business. That money's going to come back. But to really have a small amount of working capital made such a difference. It has made such a difference.
I'm Priya Mahadeva.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Purdue University Northwest is hosting a series of virtual conversations beginning this afternoon with scholars and community experts to talk about what is called the post-COVID world. And we have with us the organizer of the events coming up. Richard Rupp is the interim chair of the Department of Political Science, Economics, and World Languages at Purdue Northwest, and he is with us. And Richard, thanks for joining us on the program.
Well, good morning, Chris. Thanks so much for inviting me back to the show.
Well, it's going to be an interesting series of conversations coming up. Will you tell us a little bit about the thinking behind creating this the discussion series that begin today and continue on for several months about the post-COVID world?
Well, I'd be happy to. So PNW has been running a very successful series on racism since the fall. Basically, these have been monthly events, and they have featured primarily our scholars at the university with some experts from outside. And these have been monthly events, and some of them have been as high, been as well attended as up to 300 people. And so we thought we would broaden the scope of a spring series and call it On the Other Side, PNW Examines the Post-COVID World. Mm-hmm. Our thinking was, this world of ours, as we all know, has changed dramatically in the last year, and that change is going to continue. I was celebrating my dad's 90th birthday last night. He's out in San Francisco. And, you know, my parents are depression babies, and that depression dramatically changed the rest of their lives, and as World War II dramatically changed America again. So I think this is an opportunity to think about how the world will change. And so what we decided to do was to find four topics. We have more than four topics because, frankly, everything's going to change in the world. But four topics where PNW is particularly strong with internal experts and scholars, and then find community experts to come in. So we're launching it today at noon. The first series is, again, it's called On the Other Side, PNW Examines the Post-COVID World. And our first series panel will be on leadership. Mm-hmm. And we've assembled four really terrific scholars and practitioners here in the region. I'll give you a quick description of it.
Okay.
The global pandemic has challenged leadership at all levels and contexts. Many leaders have had to find new ways of leading as they deal with crisis and changes in how their organizations operate. How has leading through the pandemic changed how leaders set priorities and affect change? What does leadership look like in the post-COVID world? So we've got two of our, one of our scholars, Rachel Clapp Smith of our Leadership Institute, joined by a scholar from the University of North Carolina, Janaki Guti, and then probably a couple of folks you know from the region, Chris, Craig Dwight, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer for Horizon Bank, mm-hmm. and Dean Mazzoni, the President and Chief Executive Officer of Franciscan Health. So in an hour or so, they'll be sharing their thoughts, and then we will open it up to the community for their questions and comments.
That's great. Now, coming up on Monday, March 22nd, is the second in the series of Zoom conversations. Tell us about that.
Well, that's our focus there is going to be on cybersecurity. And, you know, that's cybersecurity, of course, was already going at a gallop prior to COVID-19. But COVID-19 has raised those ante substantially and has changed the debate yet again. So PNW is at the forefront of the formal research study of cybersecurity. We were very pleased last year, one of our largest grants ever from the National Security Agency of $5.9 million is now at PNW, and that's going to be focused on developing training for individuals in cybersecurity. So we're going to be talking about that, but we also have another great community leader, Robert Johnson, will be on hand. And as you know, Robert is president and CEO of SimCorp, which focuses on cybersecurity. So they'll be teasing out different components of the debate. You know, I'm not going to be on the panel, but, you know, if I were on the panel as a political scientist, I'd probably be talking about the issues most recently related to Russia and the extraordinary hacking of the United States. So that's what we'll be doing on March 22nd.
That's great. Well, I've had a chance to talk with Mr. Johnson, and he's very, very smart, very competent, and he has a great company, and luckily it's based here in Northwest Indiana. So he's very much entitled to talk about the cybersecurity issue, to be sure. It'll be interesting to hear what he has to say about that.
We were really keen on bringing in external experts. Mm-hmm. You have that happy marriage between the research scholarship and the folks who are actually in the field, and Robert is more than in the field.
We're talking with Richard Rupp, who is in charge of the political science as well as the economics and world languages area at Purdue Northwest, about the series of virtual conversations that are underway here for the next few months, at least once a month. And the next in the series in April is coming up on Tuesday, April 20th. And I understand it's entitled On the Other Side, Social Media. And you've got some interesting people on campus as well as from the region that are going to talk about that.
Right. So we should bring you in, too. I mean, you're one of our social media giants in the area there, Chris. The idea was to, again, take a look at an area where the university has considerable expertise, and also we decided to bring in Jim Dedalo, who talks of WJOB, who does talk a lot about social media
right.
and the changing impacts. Social media is such a broad topic. And actually, Chris, what I would tell you is that before all these forums, all of our speakers get together and they have quite a lengthy conversation about what they want to talk about, because we're trying to have some common themes. Basically, what will transpire in the hour and 15 minutes is there'll be about 30 minutes of provided commentary by our experts, and then we will open it up to the community. So social media, we have Matt Hansen from PNW and Ron Terrell. Matt's in College of Business, and Ron is in the College of Communication. And again, Jim, as you know, all over the media. We'll be looking at the changes in social media. They're just, you know, for you and I, we're soon to get our shots for the COVID, but you know, these young people are in a wholly different world mm-hmm. than certainly myself. And so we'll be talking about the changes in social media, the challenges of social media on a variety of fronts, but again, specifically how COVID-19 might shape the changes in social media going forward. It was an extraordinarily difficult year, both COVID-19 and politically. Journalism is changing. Hopefully, you know, we can make some positive changes.
And the last of the series, looking into what you could call the post-COVID world, as being sponsored by Purdue University Northwest, is coming up on Monday, May 10th. And I understand we've got some heavyweights in the tourism and the hospitality industry here in the region coming in for that.
Well, we certainly do. So where we're looking here is that, again, there were so many topics, Chris, that we, you know, could not do. We can't do everything. How COVID will change commercial management of those big buildings in Chicago, mm-hmm. Personal finance, health care, K-12. I mean, the changes are multifaceted. But what we decided to do is focus on some areas where we have particular strength. And, of course, PNW has an amazing hospitality and tourism management center. And they are focusing on, you know, research focusing on changes coming out of COVID. You know, I was just reading the New York Times the other day, and there was a great article, it's a distressing article, about just the airline industry and how the airline industry will go forward post-COVID. They will struggle. You know, the airline industry had a great challenge responding to the post 9/11 years. This will be of a whole different magnitude. So what we'll be doing there is we've got three or four individuals coming in. Our Godwin Charles Ogbede, who's the head of our hospitality and tourism management, and a good friend to many in the region, Spiros Vladisado. So Spiros will be on hand. We're delighted he'll be there because, you know, he's at the forefront of tourism and hospitality in the region. And then we have another scholar in addition to Godwin coming in, Amanda Sissel, and she's professor and director of Event and Tourism Institute at Indiana University. So these individuals will be talking about the, you know, this is a multi-billion dollar industry, and it's been hit particularly hard, and it will change. I think we know that travel will dramatically change, and how hospitality is structured will change. But again, one of our mottos in this show is we don't want to fear the change. We want to understand the change and lead the change.
Now, Professor Rupp, if anybody is interested in watching, listening in, and participating in the series of Zoom conversations that are coming up here beginning today, can you tell us how folks can do so and what they'll anticipate having to sign up for?
Well, we've made it very easy. So today, that what they'll do is just go to our webpage, www.pnw.edu, and then actually you'll scroll down on that front page and you'll see it, the lead event, and all you'll do is click on it and it will take you right into the Zoom meeting.
Okay.
You can also Google on our webpage on the other side. And that will take you there as well. But we've tried to make it pretty easy for everybody to log on. Our racism series has worked awfully well along these lines.
Well, it's great to hear. And we should also mention, too, that all of these events that you can take a look at the coming up here beginning today are free. They're open to anybody that wants to go on Zoom by through the pnw.edu website, be sure. And, Richard, thank you very much for bringing us up to date. I hope that the event today goes well, and we're looking forward to all the others coming up here in the months ahead.
Well, Chris, I can't thank you enough for having me on. So it's always a pleasure. We'll have to talk politics again one of these
days. That's right. You know? We will. Richard Rupp is the interim chair of the Department of Political Science, Economics, and World Languages at Purdue Northwest. And he is the organizer for the series of virtual conversations getting underway today with scholars and community experts looking into the post-COVID world. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.